That we've been discussing in the past 2 days. And if you notice that I've actually been going kind of in what appears to be random directions, a little bit of math, a little bit of numerics, and just some simple examples. The reason I did that is not because I'm disorganized. No, I am disorganized. But the reason I wanted to do that is because whenever I looked at this subject when I was trying to get into it, I always felt this unease about the approach. If it was just purely numerical, I didn't know why some things needed to be done. And at the mathematical level, I didn't know how to bridge between the problems or the issues that naturally arise in these kind of equations and the approach that people take. So now let's try to bring all these things together. We're going to still use the Burgers equations as a little workhorse model. But next week, we're going to begin discussing the hydrodynamic equations. And tomorrow, we're going to look at it in a little bit more depth. In what it relates directly to the kind of strongly gravitated systems that I showed you some examples of on Monday. Just as a side remark, Scott Noble is also visiting this week. He's going to be giving, this is the guy sitting at back, he's visiting us from Rochester Institute of Technology. He'll be giving a talk tomorrow on jets and simulations that make heavy use of this. No jets, okay. No, okay. Make heavy use of hydrodynamic simulations to study accretion problems. It's going to be at 1 p.m. as part of the strong gravity program, so if you guys have time to go, then you might see also some interesting applications of what we're discussing. So let me, I'm going to write right here, because we're going to keep this. Let me just try to remind you of the basic ingredients that we discussed yesterday. And as we go along, we're going to add some extra twists. So we began by considering equations that we could write in this form. Equal 0, or perhaps a source. The limit for the moment, just think of it as being 0. The particular approach that we're taking to do this the numerical discretization or numerical approach to dealing with this equation is called finite volumes approach. And I'm going to stress the same thing that Matt stressed last week, where he's noted that there are many other techniques that you could choose to use, but this is kind of a set of robust techniques where you see what's going on. It gives you a very good control. You know what each of these steps you're taking are doing, and you have a good understanding of what and how the solution will approach the analytical solution that is underlying, the one you're trying to get, as you decrease the cell size. There are other techniques that people use. One typical or one of, common one is called smooth particle hydrodynamics, where you represent the fluid as a collection of particles. We're not going to get into that, but that's another common technique, which has some advantages and also some disadvantages. At the moment, we're just keeping with the simplest possible one, where every single step is well understood and we know what we're doing. So when we wrote this equation, we were assuming that our variables Q, the ones that we want to update in time that are describing our fluid, obey these kind of equations. And as you will see in a few minutes, when we try to write the equations for hydrodynamics, this is not going to be the case as easily. We're going to have to introduce new variables. And so we're going to distinguish two set of variables. The variables Q, which we're going to call conserved variables. Which are the ones which we're going to have to introduce that are perhaps combinations of the basic variables that describe our system, such that we end up being able to write a system of equations that looks exactly like this. And so this, we're going to also distinguish variables P as the ones that we call primitive variables. And these are the ones that are naturally appear in the physical description of the systems of interest. And you'll see how in particular examples, how they are defined. So we're going to be, then continuously, we might have to go from Q to P or vice versa, depending on the particular step that we're thinking about. Of course, if we're thinking about the sources of instances of this, say, a fluid being source of curvature for instance equations, we need to get what the primitive variables are, for instance. So therefore, if we update the value of the variables Q, at some point, we're going to have to recover the P's, the primitive variables, so that we can use them as source for the for instance equations. So again, let me just throw this cell. Assume that the center of the cell is at xi. We have a left boundary, xi minus a half, and right boundary, x plus I plus a half. We think this is time one, time two, which is at a distance delta t in time. Time is called that way, with the previous slice. And we said that in order to iterate this equation, we're going to follow a few steps. We introduce this flux reconstruction for this flux calculation due to rho. Right, let me just put this in here. Which is defined, say, at the cell I plus a half to be given by 1/2 flux. So we calculate the flux at this cell boundary to be just a half of the fluxes. The flux has been, look, let me just write this here. Oh, that's okay. Evaluated with respect to what an approximation on the left and right sides of the cell would be, assuming again, remember that we are discretizing or we're reinterpreting the value that these functions will have, these variables would have as a piecewise constant function. So there, as a result, we might have a left state and a right state where there is a jump. What we would guess from the left side or the right side would be different. And we're going to adjust our scheme to account for that jump, and that's precisely what this piece is doing. I'll tell you the definitions of these three quantities next. Yes.
So how are these p variables defined?
You'll see. So depending on the problem, so the p variables are your primitive variables, are the variables that you will naturally choose to describe the state, the physical state of your system. But the equations that determine the evolution or that govern the dynamic behavior of this piece might not come in this simple form. And so what we might have to do is introduce a combination of p's, which we're going to call q's, and the q's can be written this way. Once we look at the hydrodynamic equations, you'll see how these q's are defined. So let me just introduce these other definitions. Or remember, we defined, and here, notice that the fluxes are evaluated with respect to the primitive variables, which have to be obtained. Once we update the q's, we obtain what the p's are. So we're going to have, and you'll see in your homework, transformations between Q and P and vice versa. So here, these values left and right is what we would reconstruct, or what we would guess, or what we would use to approximate the value, the left state of a particular variable from what we know at the cell center. So if at the cell center we know the value, say, pi for one of the variables, we'll say the value at the left side of that cell is given by the value that we have in the middle plus a given slope times the distance, and that slope we get from this mean mod. And this mean mod is there so that we can compute. Notice that this is si minus, say, si plus a half is equal to so here what we do is we compare the slope here in this cell and the slope to its left side, and if they are of the same sign, we take the minimum value of the slope, the smallest value of the slope, and if they have different sign, we just set it to zero. And we say, because that's what is, will happen, for instance, if we have a shock at this continuity here, we would have, say, the slope with a given value, and here with exactly the opposite value, we then recognize that there is a shock or there is a discontinuity in this cell, and we're saying we cannot use smoothness to do a better approximation to what the value of the left side would be, and we just say, let's copy it as a first order approximation.
And why do we need the minimum slope?
Just also, you want to avoid excessive, so otherwise, you might have things like, so you want to follow this as well as you can, otherwise you might end up having these oscillations. So this also minimizes those oscillations.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, that's a really important point, because a lot of these are constructed so that you maintain a monotonicity graph, you never introduce an additional oscillation.
You try to minimize the cell-to-cell variation of
the
Say again?
You prohibit new extrema forms.
Yes.
Explicitly.
And in doing so, you're giving away accuracy, but you're saying, well, add discontinuities that cannot do better than that. And you just are content with following this discontinuity at the right speed. So this is for here. I have to still define these three guys, which we have already discussed to some degree. So the lambdas and the R's are the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. Of the matrix that results from linearizing the equations. So the matrix A is defined to be df dq, and you have to evaluate that at the cell, so we have to do this problem in every single cell. So say at the cell I plus a half, this evaluated at I plus a half, which means the Q that appears here is given by 1/2 Q right at I plus a half plus Q left at I plus a half. So again, notice that here we obtain what the value at the left and right sides are for the primitive, and here our argument is the Q, so we use these values, obtain the Qs, and those are the ones we use to evaluate the matrix. Once we have the matrix, we look for the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and this is what lambda and R are. And finally, these omegas result from solving this equation, which just is the jumps. So all these are the
left by that one you just parsed.
Where at? This one?
Q left, yeah, Q left sub I.
I plus a half, sorry. So when obtains, what would be the Q?
It's just the index structure of the balance. So.
Okay, so now, even if we assume that all the functions are smooth, at this level what we've done is obtain a second order approximation to what the values would be at the cell interface in space. I still have to tell you a recipe to advance in time, which would be second order. The recipe we'll use is just say a Runge-Kutta second order scheme. And we follow this recipe where we're going to go from this level to this level, but evaluating an intermediate step, and from there we take another half step forward. So it's going to be by this rule. If I imagine that this is level n, and this level n plus 1, take the value of Q at the level n, we update to an intermediate level, we then obtain an approximation to what the values of Qs are at the mid-level, we use them in the right-hand side, and we take a step between n and n plus 1, where we are now using an approximation to the state of the functions at the intermediate level, where L of Q at some given n, and it's given by okay, so this is now our prescription, and you can see that it has several steps involved, so this is far more complicated than the wave equations you were solving last week. So again, imagine that you have the full solution at the level n, which is given by this primitive variables p. From there, you have to obtain the Qs, say if you haven't saved them from the previous step, so armed with Pn and Qn, what you have to do is now evaluate the appropriate fluxes at both interfaces, which requires the knowledge of the characteristic structure of your matrix. Evaluate the fluxes. Once you have the fluxes, you compute the intermediate level. Now you have the Q bars. From the Q bars, you might have to obtain the P again. And from there, you do that the next step to the next level. OK, so let's put this aside for a moment, and let's try to see how this will look like for, say, the Berger's problem. And then we'll discuss how it would look like for the hydrodynamic equations, which is what we've been promising all along to look into. So let's look at the Berger's case first. So we start with that equation. I can put the 1/2 inside. So that means that f of q 1/2 q square. The matrix A, remember what we did is we defined the matrix A by linearizing the flux. So this is just q. Of course, the eigenvalue associated to that matrix is just q. And we have a single equation, which means the eigenvector associated to this eigenvalue, which we define to be r, this is 1. And so if we use our definition for the flux now, this would be just 1/2. So at any given boundary, we have to evaluate the flux, which is given by this here. Instead of, we don't have a summation because we have a single vector and a single eigenvalue. The eigenvalue we have to put with an absolute value of the eigenvalue multiplied by the jump. Again, this jump, there is only one variable, one state of the system. So the jump is just the difference between the value that that variable has at the right and left sides. And this is just a flux, where, of course, these guys have to be determined using this mean-mod strategy. So in the code, in that second example that you guys should have hopefully by now downloaded, all these pieces are there. You'll recognize there is one that has the Jacobian. The eigenvalues and the jumps are calculated. There are places where the fluxes are computed. And the useful thing that in this case, or the simple characteristics of this problem is that there are no p's. The q's are the p's. We didn't have to introduce any new set of variables to write down the system in conservation form, in this form. And there is no source. Also, in the homework, before we actually look a little bit at the hydrodynamic equations in the homework, you're asked to implement these, but also the code has these equations implemented with straightforward finite difference equations, where this right-hand side, this second term is treated in different ways. So one way is to imagine that you're discretizing these equations. So these equations are straightforwardly. So you have some q, t, plus 1/2, say, q square evaluated at plus 1/2, plus 1 minus 1/2 q square at I divided by delta x equals 0. This here, notice that, let's say we're doing qn plus 1 minus qn divided by delta t at the point this is I and I minus 1. So what we're doing here is if we look at two time levels, level n and n plus 1, and this is the I point, you're doing the Kranz-Nicholson time difference part just as you were doing last week. And now you're choosing as a combination to take the derivative of this 1/2 q square. And the derivative, so this point I, is taken by between the point I and I minus 1. So your stencil looks like this. So then this is an average in n and n plus 1. Let me just put it. Let me rewrite this. There we're taking, this would be the stencil, so this sideways derivative. We're evaluating what happens at the point I by using information to the left of it. That's one of the options we have. Another option is to do this one, where we actually take the derivative. And so the equation that one is iterating is actually q, t plus q, q, x equals 0. And so you have qn I and let me just write n plus a half to denote the average between n and n plus 1. Sorry, 1 over delta x. And you're going to check this solution, well, the solution obtained with these two methods, and you'll see that in one case, at least you get the shock speed correctly. And this can be understood in simple terms. Let me just argue here about it. So if I have this equation, qn plus 1 minus qn divided by delta t, and I take this equation, now the thing I have here is a squared minus b squared. If this is, say, a and b, I can write this using the polynomial expression a plus b times a minus b. So I have and what you recognize in here is just the derivative, the q comma x, but what we're putting for q, rather than being the value that q has at the level I, we're actually putting the average of qn plus 1, qn at the intermediate time level of I and I minus 1, and that's precisely this shock speed. The shock speed, remember when we looked at the Riemann problem, that the shock speed was q left plus q right divided by 2, so this is playing the role of the velocity, this would plus I. So you'll see that one of the two of those methods at least get the shock speed correctly. So you'll play around with three different options for a direct finite difference approximation. You'll see the behavior of the solution and whether you have some extra spurious oscillations or not for the Riemann problem, and then you'll treat it using this high-resolution shock capturing methods, and you'll see how much more control the solution results if you actually go through the pain of doing all these steps. But as we were saying yesterday, make sure you download and you try to get going on this as soon as possible, because it does involve significant more work from your part. You're going to have to write some simple piece of code for taking care of the different stages in here. You're provided with the model code for Berger's equation. So get going with this, and then you'll see how much more complicated it will get once we get into the hydrodynamics equation. So let us discuss that case now. So the equations for relativistic hydrodynamics, we're going to ignore the effects of gravity for the time being, so we're going to just assume that we're in special relativity, and we just want to know the description of a fluid. The equations of motions are determined by two sets of equations. One is the continuity equation, which is precisely the equation we discussed the other day that says that A, well, we're ignoring all the effects of curvature, so let me just use a flat space derivative. A equals zero. So this is just the equation that said that, say, the density within a given cell, so the total mass within a given cell, had to change by the amount of flux that is crossing into or out of that cell, where UA, saying that if you take UA to be 1 and B, we would recover exactly that equation, right? It would be dt of rho 0 plus the x, say, in one dimension, rho 0 times B equals 0. That's exactly the equation we solved the other day. But now we're going to have to be careful because we're going to be enforcing the special relativity. So UA, there has to have norm 1. So there is a Lorentz factor that would show up in there. But we'll discuss that in a few minutes. So this is the first equation. It's just a single equation. The second one is the divergence of the stress energy tensor equals 0. So, which is just the conservation of energy and momentum of the system. I have to tell you what TAB is going to be. TAB, so we're going to assume a perfect fluid, which essentially says if you're co-moving with the fluid, we are in the rest frame of the fluid, what you just see is an isotropic distribution of fluid that has some given density and some given pressure. When you go into a lab frame, the stress energy tensor then can be written as rho plus P, UA, UB, plus GAB, that's pressure. And notice I have changed my, there is a significant difference between here and this equation. Here I have rho 0, here I have rho. The difference, this is the rest mass of the fluid. Well, here is the internal energy is incorporated. So rho and rho 0 are related by another variable. This one is the one that accounts for the energy that the fluid might have just by having a dynamic, have some kinetic energy, for instance. So we have a total of, so now if I, what are the primitive variables of my problem? To completely determine what the state of this fluid is at any given time, I have to give the density, the internal energy, the pressure, and the four vector. So if we count the number of variables that we have, well, let me just put rho 0. 1, 2, 3, plus 4, 7, seven variables in total. And here I have one equation, and here I have four. So I have a total of five equations. So we need two more. So there is an easy one that I haven't accounted for. Yes?
Sorry, the variables that we want to solve for are the velocity?
So we have, if I want to completely describe, say, what the stress energy tensor of the fluid is at any given time, I have to give the internal rest mass density, the internal energy, the pressure, and the four fluid vector, the four velocity vector of the fluid. So if I count the number of equations I have here, I only have five. four coming from this equation, p goes from 0 to 3, and one coming from here. Can anyone guess what are equations I may be missing? There's a single one. Yeah, you know that. So this, the obvious one is this one, which I haven't yet to, of course, impose. So if I'm using signature minus plus plus plus, so this is one extra equation. And another one is an equation that relates, it's an equation of state. With, for instance, ties the pressure with as a function of rho zero and epsilon. So this has to be given by hand. So it's, we're going to have to specify these. And two particularly simple ones, or the ones that we're mostly going to be using, is pressure given by a constant times rho zero times epsilon. That's the ideal gas law. This is a constant. It's a constant, gamma minus 1. That's gamma is a constant, gamma minus 1 is a constant, but for reasons we keep it that way. Let me just change things here. Of course, we're going to talk about this more tomorrow. We're going to take a simpler situation so that we can ease our way through, which is the one we're going to say that whatever our fluid is doing, it is moving at ultra-relativistic speeds. And therefore, rho, which is related to rho zero this way, is essentially rho zero epsilon. So that's just a limit. In that limit, we're going to be able to ignore this equation and simply deal with this equation. And also in the equation of state, let me, which is right, p equal gamma minus y times rho, and we're going to go work through with that. Okay, now let's try to see what the equations of motions are then for this case. And also we're going to try to simplify the discussion a little bit more because in the end we're just trying to see how things are complicated when we describe these kind of systems. Let us imagine that there are two extra Killing fields or symmetries in the problem, so nothing depends on ddy or ddz are both Killing fields. So they are symmetries of the problem. So nothing depends on y and z. So we choose coordinates, then tx, y, and z. So these two are do not play any role. So let us write this system. So let me take b equals 0, which is time. And our equation then says dt, t plus dx, tx equals 0. And here's where we encounter, if we don't yet spell out what TTT and TTX are, we can see here that we have an equation that looks like the conservation form that we were after. So if we, our variable, if we can have a variable that keeps TTT there, then this is already doing what we wanted. We might have to pay the price that TTT is a combination of our basic variables, and indeed that's the case. So if I look at TTT, so that's rho plus p ut square, plus p TTT. And I can rewrite this in the following way. It's rho plus p. Ut, you remember what it is. So we have this condition, ua, ua equal minus 1. So we might try to get rid of this constraint as soon as we can. And we're going to do it right now by imagining then that our fluid velocity is 1b times the Lorentz factor, where w is 1 over square root of 1 minus b squared. And if you do go through the 3 plus 1 decomposition, this is something we'll do tomorrow, then you realize that this v is the velocity that that an observer would measure given a space like hypersurface defined at t equal constant, then that observer would measure that the velocity of the fluid is v. So I can replace ut by w squared. And in doing so, we already got this constraint into account. Otherwise, we have to keep track of it. But as you'll see later, it will come back and play a role. So now our variable is this TTT like that. And we might as well define a special name for it. We're going to give it tau. So this is one of the variables we're going to introduce to write things in conservative form. Now let's take the R component B equal X. That's the only one that will have a non-trivial information. Y and Z will play no role. So then we have the XT plus DX equal 0. And again, we have now an equation that has the right form, but we have to introduce another variable, and TXT is from here, rho plus p UTUX. This one doesn't contribute because TX upper matrix is GTX is 0. And then this UT is W, and UX is V times W. So this is the same thing as rho plus p W squared V. And because motion can, the velocity of the fluid only has one component, let me just write it as V, not VX. So we're going to give it another special name to this one, and it's S. Okay, now we begin to see several differences with our simple Berger's equation toy model, which is we have two variables to solve for, tau and S. These variables are not our primitive variables, which were, say, rho and p. So our primitive variables is rho and v, or p and v. Because rho and p are determined trivially by just a constant. We're going to choose this as our primitive variables. The conservative variables are tau and s. So now our equations can be written as, say, the TDT of tau plus DX of TTX, which is the same thing as of S, and T of S plus DX plus S V plus P equals 0. Well, we have, so TXX for completeness, let me write what TXX is. It's rho plus P UX UX plus P GXX. So it's rho plus P is omega square V square plus P. And here there is an omega square missing. No, that's okay. Right, S here is, I have rho plus p omega square v is what I define S, so this S times v plus p. Okay, so now our Q is a vector that has tau and s as component. We have flux for nef that also has two components, given by s and sv plus p. And our equation is then dt of q plus dx of f equals 0. So here is comes the perhaps the most delicate part of everything we've done, and in all these transformations all this construction. I mean, this is sufficiently messy, but it's straightforward. But something that actually can be an industry in itself is this transformation. The transformation of primitive into conservative is just a simple algebraic relation. We just multiply basic variables, and we obtain the tau and the s. But remember, we said we were going to have to go from tau, from the conservative variables to the primitive variables, and vice versa at different stages in the problem. And the relationship is nonlinear. So we look at this one. So the velocity, for instance, shows up here as 1 over 1 minus v squared. So the transformation between conservative variables and primitive variables could be tricky. So for this particular problem, the transformation from conservative to primitive is defined this way. Rho is equal to 1 over gamma minus 1. So this is a transformation that given variables, the given conserved variables at a given stage, we can go back to the primitive variables, rho and v, in this way. But we have to be careful, because we're not doing this analytically, we're doing it numerically. Numerically, we're going to have some small errors, and these errors can come and give unsensible values for rho and p. In particular, just physically speaking, you want the density to be greater than 0. It doesn't make any sense to have a negative density. And the velocity to be such that its absolute value be less or equal to 1. But numerically, you might have these errors that might end up inducing violations of either one of these. And in fact, typically, that's one monitor of your numerical evolution, is to see where your transformation between conservative and primitive gives rise to sensible solutions or not. So notice one thing. So if you want the density to be greater than 0, so you have this relationship, it better be that tau be greater than s. If tau is less than s, this is negative, where gamma is in between 1 and 2. So this should be negative, and therefore the quantity inside the square root would be smaller than 2b tau, and we're subtracting 2b tau, and we're going to have a negative energy density. So we're going to have to look out for that. If we have a situation where the density might be negative, then we're going to force it by hand not to satisfy that. I'll tell you what the standard trick is. And similarly here, we want b to have absolute value less than 1, and here, if what we'll see in this particular case, if tau is greater than s, then this, and we're satisfying the rho greater than 0 condition, then we're dividing by something that is actually smaller than 1. So if we take care of this one will be taken care of automatically in this particular case. In the general case, we might have to take care of a few things at the same time. So when everything fails, brute force helps. And if it doesn't work, you probably didn't use enough of it. this is what the strategy we're going to use here. For these particular cases, there is something that there's a whole industry about it, is just flooring variables. Where you remember what we say it is, what we want to know is that tau, we want to enforce that tau is greater than s. So at different instances in the code where this transformation is playing a role, we're going to define tau to be the maximum of tau, and back absolute value of s. So what that means is the following. So floor is going to be a very, very small number, the smallest number that you can live with, so that for all intent purposes, the only thing you're doing is setting tau is the maximum between tau and a very small number. Therefore, you just pick the right value of tau. But if tau ever happens to be below this number, then you're just going to take this number. And typically, this doesn't happen where the fluid really matters. If you're evolving or simulating a star, for instance, like the ones you saw in the movies, the RDAs, and the ones that if you go to the accretion disk that Scott will show you tomorrow, then at the place where the fluid is doing something sensible, where it's doing, where you have real contributions of fluid, you don't encounter this problem. The problems typically are encountered in areas where you should have vacuum. In reality, one never has a vacuum because one of these variables not in here. We don't have it here. Yeah, let me think about this one. So suppose S was rho plus P times omega squared times V. Suppose you're trying to recover V out of S, and you know rho and you know W. You want to divide by that. But if the density happens to be zero, and therefore the pressure will be zero, so we're going to be trying to get the velocity at a point where we'll be dividing by a zero. Of course, the S will be zero as well at that point, but zero over zero is something that computers don't handle well. So what we do is typically outside where there should be vacuum, what we have is a very, very small tenuous density that prevents these things from going on. And that's the reason why we want these floors to be as small as possible so that they don't have dynamical impact in the simulation. So this is one of the prices we have to pay in order to be able to implement these kind of schemes that work really well at handling shocks correctly, but then the poison comes in one way or another. Okay, so let me just say a few more things about this problem. So remember our steps. Now I erase. So we have the equation's determined. We have our primitive and conservative variables. And we have to carry out all these steps. So in particular, we have to obtain the matrix A, which is just the derivative of F with respect to Q's. Let me just rewrite what F was. So F was that. So we need to derive df with respect to Q, and then we're going to evaluate at the right interface. We're going to use the right interface values to evaluate the matrix A. But formally, we can just plug ahead and get the A. The problem is now that these fluxes, in the way we've written, have both conservative and primitive variables. Remember, S is a conservative variable, but V is a primitive, and so is P. So when we take this derivative, be very careful to realize that at this level, where we're taking derivative of F with respect to the conservative variables, we have to use it. V is a function of Q, and P is also a function of Q. It's easy to miss that condition. So if you do that, let me just give you the answer. So A1, so the derivative of A with respect to tau is of course 0. The derivative of A with respect to S is 1. The derivative of A, F1, the first component, with respect to it, tau is 0, and with respect to S is 1. F2, with respect to tau, is given by this expression. This dp d tau is given by minus 2 beta plus is defined, and dpds, this is, you can see it in equation 53, I'm not going to write it, but just here what I'm trying to stress is that it could be a god-awful mess, and even in the simplest possible case that we thought of here, where there is no dependency in y and z, and we took the ultra-relativistic limit to drop one of the variables and one of the equations, one might end up to having to deal with things like that, but fortunately it's a calculation that you do once and it's there for all times. Then you just write the appropriate module that has this information coded in, you pass the right information, so you, if you pass the value of the conservative variables at the interface boundary, it comes in here and can evaluate and it can evaluate the different components of the Jacobian. And same thing, once you have a matrix and you know the structure, these coefficients that are to be evaluated, you can also solve for the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. That's, again, if just check section, check equation section 6. So the eigenvalues and eigenvectors for the resulting Jacobian or the resulting matrix are specified. And the jumping conditions are solved for as well. So you are provided all the analytical information. You're going to have to write or express modules that take each one of these steps. So as I was saying earlier today, and Matt was stressing also at the beginning of the week, try to get going on this as soon as possible because it's messy. There are too many steps that need to be done. Every single step is simple. But just take advantage that we're around so that we can give you input on how to do things. So as I said, the first thing is download the Berger's equations. Everything is there is built in, including these three different finite difference approximations to integrated equations and compare that with what you would get for using these row solvers, and then slowly begin to think how you're going to modify every single part to accommodate for now the fact that at the very least you have two variables to solve for instead of one, and now the matrix is a 2x2 matrix just instead of a single real. Any questions? Okay, so I'm going to assume tomorrow that we more or less know how to integrate these type of equations, and I'm going to just give you the full presentation of the 3 plus 1, similarly to what Matt did last week for Einstein's equations. I'll do the same thing for the general relativistic hydrodynamic equations. You'll see how this already kind of messy situation of conservative to primitive variables shows up in a much more complicated form. But then on Friday, we're going to kind of put a stop, and we're going to concentrate again on helping you guys out in your homework. So it's a lot more important to us that you know how to do even this relatively simple problem correctly, and from there we can decide where to go. But so then Friday, we're going to assume that during the morning, we're going to have kind of a tutorial as well. We'll decide, depending on how you guys are, where to do it here or do it upstairs. And then we'll also try to have a session in the afternoon just to make sure that this problem is pinned down as much as you can. Thank you.